This is an ABC podcast.
Today, an interesting turn of events in Queensland, with Pauline Hanson at risk of losing her Senate seat to the Legalise Cannabis Australia party.
Who would you send your sort of non-right-wing votes to? And you think, okay, well, legalise marijuana, they're probably kind of pretty libertarian, so we might give them a vote as well.
And we go to the town where, despite a murder and fatal road crashes in the past few years, locals still hesitate before they call the police.
Now, with our police officer gone, our closest port of call is Orbost. So that's 2 hours away. That's if there is someone there stationed at Orbost at the time. So say I see something suspicious or frightening, I know that it's a minimum two-hour wait.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country. While Labor's election victory has been celebrated in parts of the country, regional Queensland remains coalition heartland. Some safe LNP seats saw swings towards Labor, but it's left many in farming and mining regions worried that inner city electorates and their embrace of the Greens will deepen the regional divide. This report from Rachel McGee.
In central Queensland, the ripple effects of Labor's election victory are being felt on Richard Fairley's herb farm.
I'm concerned. I think everyone in Australia should be concerned. Even if you voted Green, we're in for a big, big shock over the next 3 years, in my personal opinion.
His property is in the electorate of Flynn, which was narrowly won by the LNP's Colin Boyce. The region is rich in agriculture and mining and home to the coal-fired Callide Power Station, a major employer for Billawheela. Mr Fairley is worried that under Labor, backed by a green and teal heavy crossbench, the transition to renewables will be too fast.
It's a real concern. I don't think they're going to put enough thought into it. They just want it to happen now. They think they're going to solve the bushfires, the rainfalls, the empty dams overnight by acting fast.
Labor does not hold a single seat north of Blair, just south of Noosa, with the LNP retaining 70% of federal seats in Queensland. Southwest Queensland grazier George Scott says support for the Greens in the southeast was a surprise.
It's certainly something that gives me concern in terms of where agriculture aligns itself and where we sit in the bigger picture. We certainly feel that at times we're taking an unfair level of responsibility for emissions in Australia, particularly cattle, but all of agriculture seems to be an easy whipping boy for climate change. And we certainly feel that a lot of that is undeserved and uneducated to an extent.
He says agricultural voters are mostly loyal to the LNP, but Labor's election win and changing attitudes in the southeast are reasons for him to self-reflect on his own beliefs and where they align.
We're generally a very, very loyal voting bloc. Therefore, one side takes us for granted and the other side takes no interest because nothing much is going to change how we vote. So I think our rural seats and agriculture in general suffers from that. It's a time for us, and me personally, and it's a time for us in agriculture to consider whether or not we are becoming too disconnected. The majority of public opinion seems to be moving further away from us. So we have to give that, I think, as a voting bloc and as participants in our society, we have to consider where we're sitting and why we're there and whether or not we actually do need to adapt.
For Central Queensland pharmacist Grant Oswald, Labor's win makes him nervous for the future of the mining town he serves.
As much as I agree that we need to do something about climate change and everything like that, but we also still need to protect our industries and our jobs and our regional towns.
He believes the regional divide will deepen unless the new government makes a conscious effort to work with regional communities.
You know, we wish we could get those people up here to the bush and actually see what we do up here and, you know, what the agriculture industry means to us and, of course, what mining industry does too and what they do for our little towns.
Queensland Labor Senator Murray Watt says the party has made a real effort after the 2019 election to reconnect with regional Queensland and believes swings away from the LNP this time were the result of that.
We spent a lot of time out there listening to people, meeting with different groups to understand why people reacted so badly against us in 2019. And I think we have gone some way to addressing the issues that people want to see addressed in regional Queensland. So we put forward a lot of really strong policies about new industries, how we could create jobs, how we could maintain our traditional industries, and importantly, how we could continue to improve health services and other services, which is such a big issue in regional Queensland.
He says the election results show the city-country divide is closing.
We're coming more to the centre in Queensland than where we were, say, 3 years ago. I think after the last election, there was a really massive divide between the city and the bush in Queensland when you looked at the swings that went against Labor in particular in around those coal regions. But as I say, this time, those margins have come in a lot more. Overall, I think that the results are much more coming towards the middle.
Rachel McGee with that story from Rockhampton.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
You're with me, Sinead Mangan. We're going to stay in Queensland now, where Pauline Hanson is fighting to keep her Senate seat. The challenge is coming from the most unlikely place, the Legalise Cannabis Australia Party. Our reporter Nathan Morris has this story.
The regional Queensland city of Toowoomba perhaps isn't the first place you'd look to find proponents of cannabis.
Oh, look, decriminalising, it's the way to go, and obviously it's good for medicinal purposes for a lot of different ailments, and should be allowed to be used for that. So I agree that it needs to be less criminal.
I know that it can cause psychotic episodes and that sort of thing in people, so yeah, I'd be pretty wary about that.
So if it was regulated, the use of it, yes. That doesn't worry you?
No, I don't. I don't think that would worry me. No, as long as it's for medicinal purposes, yes.
Right now, the race for the sixth and final Queensland Senate seat is between Pauline Hanson and Legalise Cannabis Australia's candidate, Bernie Bradley. He told ABC Brisbane this morning that he didn't use cannabis personally, but in his role as a defence solicitor, he consistently crossed paths with people being caught up in the legal system after using cannabis or cannabis products medicinally for pain or trauma relief.
People have attempted, because they couldn't afford to buy the medicine, to grow the cannabis themselves. And then, of course, they get caught, and now they're facing court with a fairly serious production of cannabis charge.
And the reason he says people are risking being arrested is because legal cannabis products are too expensive.
It is more expensive than buying it on the black market, and it's a weed. So we ran on a platform of lobbying the government to look at seriously allowing people who have a prescription to grow it.
Professor Alison Ritter is an expert on drug policy at the University of New South Wales National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. She says a 2019 survey found strong support across Australia for decriminalising cannabis.
So the personal use of cannabis should not be a criminal offence is supported by 78% of Australians. Again, that's a nationally representative sample.
But there wasn't support for other illicit drugs.
So from the same survey, only 5% of people supported the legalisation of methamphetamine and 6% supported the legalisation of heroin.
But the other factor behind the support for Legalise Cannabis Australia is disaffection with the major political parties. This is Honorary Professor Jeff Cockfield from the University of Southern Queensland.
Who would you send your sort of non-right-wing votes to? And you think, okay, well, legalise marijuana, they're probably kind of pretty libertarian, so we might give them a vote as well.
And as for Clive Palmer, with his almost $100 million election spend, not even Queenslanders gave him many votes.
As far as I know, they are still in the hunt for a Senate seat in Victoria, a surprising place for them to do well. But otherwise, very, very limited and weren't in the contest for the Queensland Senate seat by the look of it.
Nathan Morris with that story from Toowoomba.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Now to take a look at a report released by the Bureau of Meteorology today, examining the factors that contributed to the devastating floods across New South Wales and Queensland. The Bureau's report found it was the perfect storm of weather conditions that led to the mass devastation, with the insurance bill from those floods estimated at about $3.3 billion, and that's still counting. National weather reporter Ben Deacon has been taking a look at the report. Now, what's the Bureau of Meteorology saying about what caused these floods, Ben?
Well, really, the floods in southern Queensland and northern New South Wales were the result of a series of perfect storms. And what was unique about this particular event wasn't just that it rained a lot for one day or 2 days, is that it rained intensely for more than a week. So more than 50 weather stations in the northern New South Wales, southern Queensland area got more than a metre of rain in a 7-day period. Mm. This is sort of at the end of February, beginning of March, and that was really what drove the historic floods.
And in terms of when they compare that historically, where does that land?
Look, the thing with floods is floods are very specific to a location. So you can have one river where it's the biggest flood of all time, and then nearby there's another river that was beaten at some point in the past. So if you look at Queensland, overall the floods weren't, they were terrible, but they weren't as great as the floods of 1893, which were truly biblical. In those floods, an area near Brisbane got over 900 mil of rain in a day.
Wow.
So that's nearly a metre of rain in a day. Now, you know, I guess as a way of comparing it, here we had a metre, you know, over a metre of rain in a week. But the thing is that it just kept coming. And the other really distinctive factor with these particular floods is the ground was already saturated by the time these rains came. So the earth didn't have any ability to take up any more water. And so that was another factor that really drove these floods.
What about the role of climate change in the floods? Because there's a lot of discussion around that. What did the Bureau of Meteorology say about that?
Yeah, so a lot of people are wondering, well, why did this happen? And with climate change being such an issue at the moment, people want to know about the role that climate change played in these floods. What the Bureau is saying that climate change didn't cause the floods, but climate change contributed to its effects. Now, the really challenging part is actually to nail down, to find those fingerprints of climate change in this particular rain event. So what people are saying is that we know that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water. And so we are seeing across Australia a trend of short-term intense rain events. But the thing is, this was a long-term intense rain event, and the climate change signature in those is a little bit less clear. Also, we know that rain in the north of Australia is increasing, but scientists also know that rain in the south is decreasing, yet this Queensland border region, it's really on the cusp between these two regions, and climate scientists I've spoke to say that the rainfall is so variable in this area that it's really hard to pick trends. And so one scientist I spoke to, he said that the climate models, the predictions of where flooding is going due to climate change in this area, it's really uncertain. And he said that's a problem because the impacts of these floods are so terrible. This is a question that science really urgently has to answer.
So it sounds from what you're saying, there's an awful lot that scientists don't know at this stage.
Yeah, and it's funny, in some ways that doesn't always come through in the way climate change is communicated, but when you talk to some of Australia's top climate scientists, I think the thing that concerns them the most and the thing that they feel is the most important is how much we don't know. They know these questions of will communities like Lismore suffer floods like this again? Will they be worse? Which regions will get wetter, which regions will get drier? These are, you know, profoundly important questions, especially for people who are hit by these floods. I mean, Lismore is a town of 40,000 people. Mm. And that town, you know, really, it's been devastated by these floods. And so you could compare these floods to Cyclone Tracy in terms of its impact. So, you know, these questions of science is how is climate change affecting extreme rainfall? It's an important question.
So with so much yet to be found out and the scientific world really needing to drill down into the information to see if they can see these trends, what can be done while this is all going on? It sounds like the science has a bit of catch up to do, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a frontier of science. And so climate scientists that I've been talking to, they've been talking about this concept that there needs to be a Manhattan Project of weather prediction.
What does that mean,
Well, what
project?
It means is, you know, in the same way that in the way they built the atom bomb or they landed a person on the moon, these were concentrations of scientific effort towards something that was felt to be very important. And so what they're talking about is building new computer models that can predict with real fine geographic accuracy what the weather's going to be tomorrow, what the weather's going to be in a week, in a month, and into the future as climate change progresses. And so they're really saying we really need an investment in science to answer these importance that people's these questions that, that people's lives literally depend on.
How fascinating. I hope somebody's listening to what you're just saying there, that has a bit of money in their pocket.
No, it's true, isn't it? So, you know, Australia's top climate scientists, they really are shaking the tin around at the moment, and there's global efforts underway to, I guess, get groups of people together so we can get this next generation of climate modelling computers, weather forecasting technology together so that we can give people, at least give them warning about what's going to happen.
National weather reporter Ben Deacon, it's always fascinating chatting. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Sinead. It's a pleasure.
I'm going to take you now to Bendock, right up on the border with New South Wales in far east Gippsland. It's a two-hour drive from Arbust, and that's how long it now takes Victoria Police to respond to incidents there after the town's permanent policeman left in 2019. Our reporter Peter Somerville went to Bendock recently to hear about why the community feels so vulnerable.
We're in the Bendock Hall on a cool May night. If you've never been to Bendock, you're not alone. It's 2 hours from Orbost, but Delegate in New South Wales is just 20 minutes away. And that isolation is part of the reason the community is here tonight.
That's something that, definitely that would be,
The town has a police station, but no police officer. The last permanent policeman here left in 2019.
Now, with our police officer gone, our closest port of call is Orbost. So that's 2 hours away. That's if there is someone there stationed at Orbost at the time. So say I see something suspicious or frightening, I know that it's a minimum two hour wait. So I have to debate whether it's even worthwhile me making that call.
That's Irene French. She's a farmer here, and I caught up with her before the meeting to find out why she's concerned about the situation.
Our neighbour just recently found a dead cow in their paddock, which they believe to be shot from the road. So that's, you know, illegal in the first instance, as well as shooting someone's animal, which is quite frightening in itself. And apparently the animal had their back legs removed. So they'd also trespassed into our neighbour's property. So quite concerning. He did report that, but he felt that that went unresolved. He thought that, there was no action taken on that. So, you know, in that instance, he did feel that it was worthwhile reporting, but, you know, having a local police officer who has local connections with the community and knows the area would have helped in that situation. Yeah.
Since 2019, Bendock has been served by police from Orbost 1 or 2 days a week. But in that time, the town has seen a murder, bushfires, COVID border closures, and fatal vehicle accidents. And Irene is not alone in being concerned. Simone Elias is a part-time resident here.
I personally don't particularly feel unsafe, but what I would like is if something were to happen, that I'd like to be able to call a police officer and for a police officer to attend within a reasonable period of time.
And were you satisfied with the meeting tonight?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't satisfied because I don't believe that the responses so far of the Victoria Police have sufficiently answered the community's concerns. Victoria Police are the largest police force in Australia and the most well-funded police force in Australia. New South Wales Police seem to have a model that responds better to their community needs, notwithstanding they have less police and they have a larger population. So there is something wrong with the Victoria Police model where in the midst of all that funding, they have to pull out a police officer of a remote communities in the Erranundra-Chisnowy district and they're not prepared to relook at that model.
Superintendent Mark Edwards said Victoria Police is prepared to review the model, but he warned Bendock's situation is not strictly unique.
Oh, look, not so much the exact same model, but we spoke a little bit about other communities that don't have a policing service at all, or policing services that are far removed from the community. So there are similarities in remote parts of Victoria and certainly other states in Australia. But I can speak mainly about Victoria, and there are certainly... this is not unique to Bendoc. Bendoc's, you know, very, very remote. But there are other very remote locations of Victoria that do experience similar issues, and we have to work through them in a policing sense and work out how we best look after the community.
Superintendent Mark Edwards ending that story from Peter Somerville, who's in Bendoc at the community meeting. With so much wet weather on Australia's east coast, getting a load of laundry dry has been a challenge, meaning many laundromats are doing a roaring trade. It's one place that's absolutely pumping in the ongoing wet weather, even at 11 o'clock at night, as our reporter Kylie Bartholomew found out when there was a wait for the dryers. Kylie got chatting with Jeanette Walker, the owner of Butterham Laundered, a 24-hour laundromat, about business at the moment and the broader role of a laundromat service in the community.
We have been, since the school holiday and the rain, we have been inundated with people coming in at 2 o'clock in the morning just to get their washing dry. At the moment, it's been crazy. Yeah. Since COVID, it hasn't been, we can normally can predict our peaks and, you know, troughs, but this year it's been totally different, and the rain has been crazy, and I think with the influx of people, it's probably why I think people move to Queensland and think they don't need a tumble dryer. And yeah, it's probably the hardest place in Australia to get washing dry.
Who are you noticing coming in and using the laundromat?
We have a real, real mix. During the day, it's a lot of the elderly. Towards the afternoon, you sort of get the mums, sort of they'll drop off, go and do the school pickup, and then come back. Around the early evening, you get the sort of younger generation coming in on their way home from work. And then in the evenings, it's sort of real mix from 30 up to, you know, sort of 50, but that sort of age group.
And locals?
We do get a lot of locals, but we get a lot of travellers. Yeah, people, especially people in the caravan parks.
And you said during COVID it was a bit predictable, but this year's been different. In what way?
This year's been really different. Our demand for service washing has been crazy. We've never
done. What is
that? So we offer a wash, dry and fold service. We've done no advertising, but it's just increased probably 30% since the Easter holidays. We do a lot of family washing, and a lot of the elderly do their bedding. Yeah, we've had a real increase in that, so that's been a big noticeable difference.
And in terms of staffing, is it just yourself, or have you got to look at putting anyone else on?
I'd have one part-time girl and my daughter. She works with me.
I mean, we've been up here at 11 o'clock and all the dryers have been full. Is this sort of like one of your busiest times?
With the rain. We did start the 24-hour service to cater for night shift workers down at Kunda Park, and people are using it. It's been really helpful, I think, to certain people in certain professions, especially, you know, shift workers. Yeah.
And how long have you had the laundromat for?
I've had the laundromat now for 4 years.
And have you always been in this industry?
No, I was a bookkeeper by trade and from the UK originally, and when I was there I worked in the travel industry. So this was a sort of a job that I sort of fell into accidentally just through one thing and another, and it's just amazing the amount of people that I meet. A lot of my customers that come in during the day just, I think, come in really to have a chat and offload. It's a bit of a therapy centre, which is lovely. We do a couple of charity jobs for... We were doing the washing for the Red Cross when they had to wash their blankets every use for COVID. And we also do the sleep bus down from Maroochydore. So we like to give back to the community. Yeah, it's sort of quite a happy place. You know, we like to help. You know, you never know what someone else is going through the day. So folding someone's washing, I've had a lady cry on me, and I've had a card brought in from the lady just to say thank you. I love the job. It's something you do every day for yourself at home, but
yeah, it does make a difference to a lot of people.
Certainly humming at 11 o'clock at night. Laundromat owner Jeanette Walker, and she was chatting there to Kylie Bartholomew there on the Sunshine Coast. And that's all from the Australia-wide team for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you're having a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.